safe and our hearts will always rise. Rabbana.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdu wa thana' lillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya'i wal-mursaleen, habib qulubana, wa tabib nufusana abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, wa ala al baytih al-tayyibin al-tahirin al-ma'asumin al-mukarramin. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. This is an honor and a blessing for me to be spending the next few minutes on the du'as of Sahifa Sajjadiyah and to be able to, inshallah, receive some nur from the words of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, especially in these nights and days of these 2 months of Muharram and Safar, which in accordance to the very famous statement from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, where he says it's because of or it's due to Muharram and Safar that Islam has remained alive. It's due to these 2 months and whatever that takes place, that there's a new life given to the movement of Islam all around the globe. And Imam Sajjad alayhi salam played a very important role, a very essential role in keeping this movement alive with the publishing of Sahifa Sajjadiyah and leaving it as a legacy for us. In this 17th dua, where Imam Sajjad alayhi salam talks about enmity with Shaitan and emphasizes on the importance of seeking refuge to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the trickery and enmity of Iblis and his followers, Iblis as the head of Shayateen, of the Satans, and his followers, his armies, from the jinn and from the human beings. It's important to remember that asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be able to have the strength to disobey Shaitan is one of the teachings of this 17th dua that we are going to focus on. Let's take a quick break and inshallah we'll come back shortly.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, respected brothers and sisters, says in this 17th dua that Allahumma ja'alna fi nadhma a'da'i. First and foremost, O Allah, place us amongst those, place us amongst the structure, amongst the army, amongst the ranks, within the ranks of his enemies. Let me be on that front. Let me be in that part, right? Let me take side with those who are confronting with Shaitan, not with his friends, right? Because these two are never combining. These two forces are always confronting. There is no dissolution, right? There is no dissolution between light and darkness. Either it's, are you on the side of the Haqq or are you on the side of Batil. says, places us, O Allah, we ask you to place us in the ranks of his enemies, and wa'azilna an 'idad awliya'ih, and remove us from the number of his enemies. To the extent that, so what happens? So what would be the benefit of this? Because once your siding is fixed, once your stance is reframed to be standing on the right side, to be taking side on the with the haq, with the truth, what happens? The very natural consequence of that is we get the strength to be able that we obey him not when he entices us, when he makes temptations to us, allow us, give power. And that power is built up on the basis of siding, on the basis of standing on the right side, on the right, within the right ranks. لَا نُطِيعُ لَهُ إِذَا اسْتَهْوَانَا, so that we can start disobeying Shaitan whenever he is making temptations for us. وَلَا نَسْتَجِيبُ لَهُ إِذَا دَعَانَا, and then we do not answer him when he calls upon us. Sometimes you know that you're making the wrong decision. Sometimes you know that you're listening to Shaitan. In Farsi, in Persian, there's a beautiful proverb that the elders, the previous generations, used it more frequently. And it basically translates into this, stop riding the donkey of Shaitan. Get off the riding of the donkey of Shaitan. Meaning that sometimes you start riding on that vehicle that takes you to the wrong path, as if you have no control. Someone else is driving. Someone else is taking you, right? You know that you're doing the wrong thing, but you do not have the audacity, the power, the ability to say no. Let's take another break, and inshallah, stay tuned with us.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Alright, respected brothers and sisters, in that this last portion of this episode, what I want to mention is that it's very important to notice the voices that we hear, the decision that we make, to be able to distinguish whether it's from our divine self, our good self, from nafs al-ammara, or from nafs al-lawwama. Nafs al-lawwama to be the good one, right? And nafs al-ammara is the one that frequently commands for the bad, for the devil, right? Be able to distinguish between the two, right? Sometimes you do not, once you're on the spot, you're not able to distinguish between the two. You listen to the whispers of Shaitan, thinking that it is your own words, right? And then Imam Sajjad in here says, the preliminary step, right? The very introductory step to be able to get to that level, to have the audacity, to have the strength to say no to the calls of Shaitan, is siding with the haq and not siding with the batil. Right? That's why he says it like this. He says, Allahumma ja'alna fi nadhmi a'da'i. Palestine is not my matter. I don't care. You're siding with Shaitan, whether you know or whether you don't know. Right? You're siding with the falsehood. ولا نستجيب له إذا دعانا, so that we answer him not when he calls to us. نأمر بمناواته من أطاع أمرنا. We command everyone who obeys our command to be his enemy. We get to that port, that rank. ونعظ من أن متابعته من اتبع زجرنا. And we admonish everyone who follows our prohibition not to follow him. Inshallah, that becomes applicable to us by the assistance and help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را, هرگز مخواه از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
A heartfelt greeting to you wherever you're tuning in from. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting straight from Tehran. Our first program is another segment of radio productions. Next, we'll cast the spotlight on critical events of the day. This daily program features a roundtable analysis and discussion on world developments. Two expert guests will provide their insightful analysis. Don't miss this in-depth look at current affairs. So keep listening. Up next, a new segment of our radio productions. Iran.
Sistan and Balochistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, these adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing?
About 40 kilometers from the city of Zabul, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an ecotourism village. Kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past two to 300 years as Dahani Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahani Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahani Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahani Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices, since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it. The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan. Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoodi for Iran.
As we continued our tour of Arras in northwest Iran, in the remote areas of the region, I found the opportunity to learn more about its history and its folklore. It is interesting to see how villagers in these remote mountains have managed to keep all their traditions alive. Traditions that go beyond simple eating habits.
Games are an inseparable part of human culture. That's why as you study any ancient civilization, you will definitely find some very old games.
The village of Gulfaraj had its own museum of anthropology, where I could find plenty of interesting information about the people that have been living here for thousands of years, including information about the local games that they played.
About games, most of us imagine a group of kids playing, but there are many games that even grown-ups can enjoy.
A game that is surprisingly reminiscent of baseball, making me wonder if this American sport actually originates in Iran. But anyhow, this game definitely encourages teamwork and requires a very fit body and healthy lungs. And as you can see, it is very popular among grown-ups. Even the elderly. Playing with knuckle bones, especially those of a sheep, is one of the oldest games that many ancient civilizations have in common. However, there are many different ways of using them. Most of the games are played by throwing them up and catching them in different manners. Again, another popular game among grown-ups as well as kids. Meanwhile, the dusty alleys of the village never seem to be quiet after school. The games are simple. You don't need anything special. A ball made of leftover bits and pieces of cloth and a few stones. Even a couple of pebbles are enough to keep the kids busy. And if everything else fails, there's always a song they can sing together.
Bandadusha is a popular game played by kids. It literally means capturing the violet, but I really don't know how it's played, which is why I'm joining them.
From what I learned, solidarity is the name of the game. One side loses when its human chain is broken by a member of the opposing team. And although they didn't use a sheep today, they still learned problem-solving skills and creativity. Yusumisha Ahmadi for Iran.
Thank you. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight, the 30th anniversary of the Srebrenica genocide, the largest mass killing in Europe since 1945. In mid-July 1995, over 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were murdered. Last year, the General Assembly designated July 11th as the International Day of Reflection and Commemoration of the Srebrenica genocide. But the international recognition appears to be in stark contrast with the denial of the U.S. and other Western allies of Israel's current genocide in Gaza. Western states and their media that denied the Bosnian genocide now deny the Gaza genocide. The indifference to civilian suffering is almost identical. Israel is using the most advanced weaponry supplied by Western capitals to pummel a helpless civilian population. This is while a network of influence entrenched in Western governments and their mainstream media has utilized all of its tools to silence the uproar against these crimes. We'll be discussing those issues and much more on tonight's edition of Spotlight with our guests. Professor of Humanities at York University, Amila Baturovich, is with us from Toronto. And we also have journalist, author, and activist, Mr. Fra Hughes, joining us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program to both of our guests. Let's start off with Mr. Hughes in Belfast. Mr. Hughes, the Srebrenica genocide has been compared to the current genocide unfolding against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. As we know, Srebrenica was also comprehensively denied at the time. Talk to us about the parallels that you would draw between these two appalling and unforgettable massacres, which many are considering stains on the international community.
Absolutely. Well, I would lay both of these genocidal campaigns at the altar of imperialism. If we look at the fall of the Soviet Union, then we look at the encroachment from the West, from NATO, up to the Russian borders, which includes the present conflict in Ukraine. So the seeds for the massacre of Srebrenica were sowed by the Americans and by the British and by NATO, who wanted to destroy the Socialist Soviet Republic of Yugoslavia, to break it down into its six component parts. They armed, financed, and gave political cover to some groups that were involved in this kind of disintegration of Yugoslavia. And then we can witness the 78-day bombing of Serbia in 1999. That didn't have a UN mandate. That was NATO, the US, and America flexing its military muscles and destroying Belgrade and Serbia and financing and arming the Kosovan Liberation Army in its struggle for liberation against Serbia. So it's Western imperialism, it's Western capitalism, it is the Western media, Western politicians who are fully complicit in the genocide that we witnessed in Srebrenica. And we only need to look at Radovan Milosevic. He got a life sentence for his part in the genocidal campaign in Srebrenica in 1995. And there were 161 different people indicted in the war tribunals based on the conflict in Yugoslavia. And yet we have Netanyahu flying over Italy, flying over Greece, flying over France as a wanted war criminal with an ICC warrant in existence for his arrest to go to The Hague for war crimes. So what we're witnessing in Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, is a continuation of the Western imperialist desire to steal the resources that belong to separate sovereign nations and independent people, such as the Palestinians. And their only issue is that the Palestinians are in the way of their capitalist greed and their designs on Gaza and the West Bank. And we will continue to watch the hypocrisy, the double standards, the double dealing, the lies and the deceit of Western politicians in bed with their military industrial complex, which is there to steal the resources at the minute. In Gaza, they're looking at the oil, they're looking at the gas, they're looking at a Ben-Gurion canal.
Sure.
They're looking at creating a high-tech hub in Gaza. It's just they want rid of the people so that they can fulfill their imperialist dreams of making money on the deaths and on the hopes and on the dreams and on the bodies of the Palestinian people.
Ms. Buturovic, in Toronto, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said that if the world had truly learned from Srebrenica, would we not be seeing another Gaza genocide against, not be seeing another genocide against Muslims in Gaza? That's a sentiment that's been echoed by many observers and analysts, that the Gaza war shows we've not learned lessons from Srebrenica. Walk us through these comments, please.
I certainly agree to a great extent with that comment. I think that we have witnessed in history over many centuries many different genocides, and we have never learned, really. The phrase never again that we have seen after the Second World War has been trampled over, basically, in Srebrenica and now again in Gaza. There have been other major massacres around the world in which the governments and the parties responsible for what has happened have not been really brought to justice. Srebrenica is an excellent example because it is one of the extremely tragic example, clearly, for one very important thing, and that is that was really the first time that things were televised in real time and we could witness what was going on. And nobody could really say we did not know or we could not, we learned only later. It was happening in real time with TV cameras present, with a really big a group of journalists dispatched there and understanding what was going on. There had been warnings again in real time, yet it happened. And it is clear that there are so many different threads that actually fell apart and that disintegrated in a way that was impossible to morally find the compass that would take care of this, that would prevent this, the genocide. Mind you, Srebrenica has been identified as genocide by the International Criminal Court and the Court of Justice in a way that at some level obscures the fact that all over Bosnia there were massacres, perhaps not to the extent in the same short amount of time, but nevertheless that the, you know, the whole legal procedure showed that there are complications at that level as well, and that this is something that we need to expect with Gaza, even though it has been identified in Gaza's case as well by the International Court of Justice that this is clear violation of human rights, unlawful occupation, a in their case, of course, a possibility and threat and recognition of genocide, yet as if legal theory and legal practice don't have much in common. This is what partly has been the tragedy, yes.
Fra Hughes, where does this leave the credibility of global bodies and institutions like the UN, which has shown that it's basically ineffective and is at the mercy of the veto-wielding supporters of the Israeli regime? How do Srebrenica and Gaza constitute the failures of the UN?
Well, it proves that the UN is a toothless tiger. It proves that it doesn't have the mechanisms that when you have countries that have a veto, when you have a permanent security council where each member has a veto, that allows a block on any type of progress. It allows a block on bringing war criminals before the Hague. It allows people who should be in jail to remain at large, to travel at will. And not only that, but to continue the genocide. I mean, there were people convicted of what happened in Srebrenica. And as I said, like Radovan Milatovic got a life sentence. But he was jailed because he's an enemy of Western imperialism. He was jailed because Serbia stood up against NATO and stood up against the Western capitalist cabal. So if you're an enemy of the United States, if you're an enemy of the United Kingdom, if you're an enemy of the European Union, they will use every method and every effort to either assassinate you or to bring you before the court. As some American diplomat or some American politician claimed that the ICC and the ICJ were only there to prosecute, basically, I'm paraphrasing this, black people and people like Putin and people like the Serbian leaders. So the enemies of Western capitalism can be brought before the courts and justly convicted if the evidence is there. But the people who are there in favour of Western imperialist machinations from Africa to South America to West Asia have absolutely no accountability. They are not held accountable for their crimes. Indeed, sure, they continue to finance them, arm them, and give them political cover.
Ms. Baturovic, on the issue of accountability, what steps, in your opinion, can be taken to prosecute Israeli war criminals? How can the issue of accountability begin to take shape? And as with Srebrenica, will it take decades to serve justice?
Yes, if I can just reflect a little bit on what the other guest has just said, Mr. Hughes. Radovan Karadzic is guilty of genocide, and whether he opposes the West or not, I think is secondary to the fact that he has been indicted and he has been given the sentence in full recognition of his accountability. So I think that the ICC does do a good job when it does when it is given a chance to do a good job. Of course, the legal process is enormously long, and it has so many components. And in fact, even bringing up the term genocide, of course, has been legally contentious, even though we use it, of course, when it is so obvious, you know, we have no other word but in fact account for what we see in front of our very own eyes. But legally speaking, and I'm not within the legal profession, but I remember from, and I know from following up the what was happening and unfolding with the International Court of Justice regarding former Yugoslavia, that every piece of evidence had to be scrutinized from many different angles. And it really became a theater of law. And it took decades, in fact, to put together something that seemed to be so obvious. So, you know, and of course there are ways in which this can be argued back and forth, and it was argued back and forth. And eventually some justice was served. But it's too little justice, and that's just one component of it. I mean, even if we indict somebody, does that mean, what does really that mean for the situation on the ground? Does that serve as a lesson? It certainly serves as a lesson, but it doesn't complete the story. I mean, we have 30 years now down the road in Srebrenica, the denial by Serbia of genocide, the denial of those who surround Srebrenica. The Srebrenica falls under the jurisdiction Republika Srpska of Bosnian Serb leadership, who deny genocide and who actually not only deny it, they glorify genocide. And there is the parallel with Gaza. We have Israel that denies the genocide. And so, you know, even if you bring one person to justice and put them in jail, you know, for life, if you have a whole state apparatus and a whole cultural apparatus that works against recognizing that genocide, taking accountability for that genocide, taking responsibility for it, then we are up against a mm-hmm. very severe stream of moral, simply incompatibility between what happened and what we have to deal with in the case of Srebrenica right. 30 years later.
Fra Hughes, how would you break down the level of complicity of Washington and its European allies in the Gaza genocide, the military and financial support in tandem with the political cover that they've given to the Israelis? A political analyst that we spoke to earlier regarding the issue echoed also what you mentioned earlier, that Western powers, particularly the U.S., have in fact been involved in other acts of genocide over the past decades.
Yes, 100%. I mean, what we're looking at is, all the F-16s, all the F-35s, the ships that the Israelis have, tank shells, the guns, the bombs, the supposed B-2 bombers that they might be supplying to Israel. This is an American war in West Asia. This is an American war on the people of Gaza. If America and American politicians stop the money, stop the political cover, stop the vetoes in the UN, stop arming Israel, this genocide would be over inside a couple of weeks. It was proven when Israel attacked Iran that they started running out of their anti-missile missiles, that they started depleting their stock of THAAD missiles and the Iron Dome and David Sling. And it proves that Israel cannot exist as a colonial footprint within the Levant and within the UMA without the direct involvement of the world superpower, which is North America, along with the EU, along with NATO, along with Britain and Germany, supplying arms and supplying tactical overflights and information. Israel is a Western construct. It's Eastern European Jews who are now living in occupied Palestine. Without America, without its support, without its bombs, it could not possibly exist in its present state. It couldn't carry out the genocide in Gaza. It couldn't continue the illegal occupations and illegal settlements in the West Bank. It couldn't bomb Iran. It couldn't invade and occupy parts of Lebanon. It couldn't invade and occupy parts of Syria. It couldn't bomb Yemen. It couldn't really exist as an apartheid state without the backing of the West. And the reason why Israel is there in the beginning is to act as a wedge, to act as a Western footprint in West Asia, to destabilize the whole region with the intention of dividing the Ummah and creating the opportunities for capitalists, imperialists, to steal the resources of West Asia from the people that it belongs to.
And the list just goes on and on. Back to Ms. Buturovich in Toronto. The U.S. sanctions, the recent sanctions against the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, Francesca Albanese, they are being seen as another clear sign of America's complicity in Israel's war crimes. Will such actions just encourage the leaders of the occupying Israeli regime to continue their brutal atrocities? And do you see this as another instance of blatant disregard for international bodies when it comes to dealing with Israeli crimes?
Absolutely. I think that one of the tragedies of International Court of Justice as well as International Criminal Court is they really don't have teeth unless somebody is there to back them up in real life, in real terms, in sort of realpolitik. And And we, you know, well, Gaza is showing us, and this is what Srebrenica showed, is this mismatch between how the politics work and how the public outcry is built. And in the case of Srebrenica, it was somewhat different. I mean, the situation was much more confined to a very short period of time. Genocide happened literally under the watchful eyes of the, you know, of the Dutch contingent at the time, UN Dutch contingent. And it happened in within basically 2-3 days, even though, of course, you know, there are, it had started earlier and it took a while to complete. But over 8,000 people were killed within 48 hours, practically. And in Gaza, it is so there was actually this immediacy that then of response that then required everybody to be on the same page, but that didn't happen. In the case of Gaza, we have an evolving situation day in, day out, atrocities being committed, and day in, day out, the larger and broader and larger gap between those who feel that something should be done and those who just refuse to do anything about it, and in fact, those who make things complicit. And Francesca Albanese is really quite a remarkable figure in that regard, because she stands so firmly on the ground of law and evokes the law, but it seems to fall on deaf ears, and people feel extremely helpless about that. And I think what is happening with Gaza, more so than it happened with Srebrenica, even though there are these important parallels, is that there is a sort of global outrage at the way in which governments seem to be disconnected from the will of the people, so that millions of people can be out in the street, but they are seen as a problem opposing the genocide rather than those who actually support the genocide.
Okay, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, Ms. Amila Baturovic, Professor of Humanities at York University, joining us from Toronto. Thanks to journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, speaking to us from Belfast. And, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Cheerful eyes, I'm thankful for this beautiful day. foreign minister says Israel miserably failed in its recent aggression against the country and could not erase Iran's peaceful nuclear program. More Palestinian women and children are killed in Israel's latest air and artillery strikes as the regime's genocidal war continues unabated. The Palestinians and the international community strongly condemn Israel's plan to relocate Gaza's entire population to a close zone near the Egyptian border. Thank you for joining us. Now, the Iranian foreign minister says Israel's prime minister has failed to achieve any of the goals he pursued through the regime's latest war of aggression against Iran. Abbas Araghchi made the remark in a social media post in reaction to Benjamin Netanyahu's recent remarks that Iran must restrict the range of its missiles to 480 kilometers. He said Netanyahu is openly dictating what the U.S. should or should not say or do in the talks with Iran, despite his regime's failure in the recent aggression. Araghchi added that it is a farce to expect Iran to accept anything a wanted war criminal has to say. The top diplomat said Netanyahu dreamed that he could erase more than 40 years of Iran's peaceful nuclear achievement. However, he added every one of the dozen Iranian nuclear scientists that his mercenaries martyred has trained over 100 capable disciples who will show Netanyahu what they are capable of. Ambassadors from 28 countries have visited the charred remains of Iran's national broadcaster's iconic glass building that was struck by Israel during a live news broadcast last month. The attack on IRIB, widely condemned as a war crime and an assault on press freedom, has sparked an international solidarity and highlighted the resilience of Iranian journalists. Gisumish Ahmadi tells us more.
Charred ruins mark the site where Israeli missiles struck IRIB's iconic glass building during a live news broadcast just weeks ago. Ambassadors from 28 nations, alongside Iranian officials and journalists, touring the devastated site. As head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB, recounts the horrific attack.
Today, the iconic glass building of IRIB is being visited by ambassadors from friendly nations. But we would have welcomed the presence of diplomats from countries that support Israel, those who constantly speak of human rights and press freedom. This devastation is a direct result of their support for the Israeli regime. Sadly, they seem to prefer closing their eyes to the truth.
The visit quickly turns into a powerful act of solidarity as diplomats condemn the strike and stress the need to uphold international law and protect media institutions in times of conflict.
Bombs and missiles cannot defeat the truth. The truth always prevails. What we witness here today is the undeniable truth of what happened.
The scenes we see here are evidence of Zionist atrocities against Iran, an effort to silence the truth. We are here to stand in solidarity with the Iranian people.
This is really unexpected for us to see the level of destruction. You know, we are told that this building was attacked repeatedly, total 11 times. But the first time when it was attacked, journalists were inside and they are running live programs. So this is totally unacceptable. Even in war field, journalists are protected.
Even in the harshest wars, journalists should never be targeted. This strike happened during a live broadcast. We strongly condemn this act of aggression.
Walking through ash-filled hallways and past burnt-out studios where just weeks ago millions tuned in for the news, anchor Sahar Emami gives a first-hand account of the June 15th attack.
I was in the studio from early morning, reporting on the Israeli attacks and updating our viewers. Around 6:30 p.m., while we were live on air, the strike happened. We knew it was dangerous, but my colleagues and I in the control room chose to stay, to report every last moment so the world could see the truth.
Cameras captured the chaos with the network's news host and director staying at their posts, determined to keep the broadcast alive until the building went dark. Their courage has become a symbol of Iranian media resistance.
We were live on national TV,